You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Anthony Richter. I'm the Associate Director of the Open Society Institute. I also direct the Central Eurasia Project. And I would like to welcome you to tonight's program on revisiting U.S. Georgia relations after the August War. I'm not going to say too much because we have a very illustrious colleague, Fiona Hill, here to run today's event. Without further ado, I'm going to hand the panel over to Fiona Hill.
Thank you very much, Anthony. I also wanted to encourage everyone to pick up a copy of the report if you haven't. I've seen some of you already have. And Alex and Lincoln brought around a lot of them, so take some for your friends as well. Apparently they have thousands and thousands of them already.
Can't walk around my own.
Yeah. And they don't want to take them home with them. So as you're grabbing what looked like a very nice marinated leg of lamb, please also take a report with you as well. I wanted to just set the scene a little bit for the event tonight. Obviously, we're 2 years out of the war in Georgia, and I don't know when any of you know much about my background, but I actually spent 3.5 years at the National Intelligence Council on loan from Brookings. And as a result of that, it was from 2006 to 2009, I had a rather unfortunate ringside seat to the, one might call this traffic collision of the war in Georgia. And I just wanted to start off tonight's presentation by Lincoln and Alex with just a few observations on the events of August 2008. I mean, at the time, obviously, they seemed incredibly momentous, and we now are standing 2 years back where things from hindsight may seem a little calmer, but also a lot more information is probably now known more broadly about what happened. But if you go back to 2008 itself, I'm actually trained as a historian, and from where I was sitting, it had all the feel of July 1914 to it, which now seems a little exaggerated when I think back on that. But it was certainly, for all of us who were observing one way or another, and I'm sure many of you in this room were as well, you may recall that these historical analogies were thick and fast thrown around when the Russian tanks started to roll down the rocky tunnel and into South Ossetia. And the metaphors of the war actually, I think, deserve to be borne in mind as we start thinking of looking forward. Because in the 2 years intervening, we've been entangled very much by a lot of these ideas. The Russians have called, in fact, the war in Georgia their 9/11, which obviously seems a little over the top from the perspective of people sitting here in New York. But there have been a number of Russian publications saying that 8/8 or 8th of August 2008 was in fact the 9/11, a number of publications indeed from a serious set of think tanks, which obviously, as one can imagine, really heightens the emotions about that kind of event by making those kinds of analogies, and that's actually fairly widespread in Russia. The Russians also hark back to the NATO bombings of Yugoslavia in 1999. In fact, for many in the Russian military, this was seen as sort of revenge. Yes. Because there was so much shock in Russia in 1999, that was really the worst point in US and NATO's relations with Russia, that NATO would decide to bomb Belgrade in reaction to the events in the Balkans in 1999, and the Russians felt, without consulting them properly, that in many respects, many of the military, some of whom had actually seen action later on in the Balkans as well as in Chechnya, felt very much this was their attempt to redress the wrongs, and making the same point that if it was good enough for NATO, it was good enough for Russia. We also had all kinds of talk and analogies with Israel moving into Lebanon in 2006. A lot of talks about this all being a proxy war. For the Russians, this was the Georgians striking a blow against Russia on behalf of the United States. And for the Russians, for the Georgians, rather, it was the South Ossetians and the Abkhazians. And the Abkhazians, of course, having not really done anything at that time in 2008, being the proxies of Russia. So it was all cast in the sense of a massive struggle for influence in the Caucasus between Russia, the United States, and the West, again heightening things. There are also a lot of analogies made by various Europeans, including most famously Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, about this being Poland 1939, Now, not as you might think of that being the Nazi Germany invasion of Poland, but that being the Russian invasion of Poland in the wake of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in defense of the Slavic peoples of Poland. And that metaphor was out there for quite a long time. There was also the invocation of a new Medvedev doctrine, hearkening back to the Monroe Doctrine that we, the United States, famously cast about a very long time ago. And the idea then that if the Russians could move against Skin Valley and Tbilisi, then Tallinn and all those other nicer places might be next. So the whole idea that this was the beginning of a rampage by reactionary Russia against all of the former Soviet satellites. Well, of course, that didn't come to pass. And then finally, another analogy that was bandied around at the time was the invasion of Cyprus by Turkey in 1974, which in fact may be more apt in many respects, with Russia playing the role of Turkey, moving in to basically protect declared co-brethren in an inter-ethnic and political dispute. Well, as a result of all these analogies, the details, the events themselves, and the origins of the war and the very specific nature of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then the fact that, the war or the conflict between the Georgian and South Ossetian empires had begun in the early 1990s was completely lost. And it was almost as if 2008 had come from nowhere out of the blue. Another issue that obviously did set the scene for 2008 was Kosovo. And I'm sure that Lincoln and Alex may talk about this, and perhaps we can talk about this a little bit more in the discussion. Because there was a precedent set in 2008 in January when, under the leadership of the US and also under NATO leadership, Kosovo's Declaration of Independence was recognized by a number of states in January. Again, harking back to the Yugoslav conflict in 1999, the Russians then made a number of direct linkages between the recognition of Kosovo and threatened, of course, that this might lead to the potential recognition of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which indeed did happen in the wake of the August war. So one can see here lots of linkages between the Balkans and the Caucasus being made very deliberately, complicating the issue even further. And also raising all the questions about the difficulty of sustaining these states. And if you think about the Balkans and even think about the difficulties we have with Kosovo, South Ossetia makes these pale in comparison. 99% of South Ossetia's budget today is coming from the Russian Federation. And although Abkhazia might become the new Montenegro, the seaside resort of the rich and famous, or maybe the not-so-rich and famous, in the Russian-speaking world, it still raises an awful lot of questions about the prospects for both of these two quasi-states when one thinks about the history of the Balkans since the 1990s. I was just in Russia about 10 days ago now, taking part in a conference at which Mr. Putin spoke. And for the first time, actually, there was a relatively positive comment about the situation by a Russian leader. There were the ubiquitous insults about Misha Saakashvili that one heard, although not from Mr. Putin this time. And he actually said something which was very interesting. He said that in response to a question asked about the future of Russian-Georgian relations, which is not really our topic today, he said that he thought that, in fact, it might be possible for Russia to stand aside while Abkhazia, South Ossetia and Georgia made up their own mind about their future relations, even if this might not end up back in a state. A very cryptic response to the question, but raises a lot of questions about where things might go from here. Basically, what Lincoln and Alex have done, however, is really produce a very important report. Because in the wake of this war, with all these mixed metaphors and all these heightened emotion and all of these analogies between the Balkans and the Caucasus, the events of 2008 did force a major reassessment on everyone's part about how relations with the region should be handled. It was a reassessment on the part of the United States, and obviously the reset with Russia, in many respects, has got its origins in the almost direct confrontation that the US found itself in with Russia in 2008. A reassessment by NATO about the question of membership for Georgia and also of Ukraine. Also for the EU, and the EU found itself more dramatically involved in Georgia than any other time in the past by the establishment of the EU monitoring mission in the wake of the war. So the EU is now very much a factor in the South Caucasus in ways it was not before. And generally, also for Georgia, a major rethinking of its own strategy towards Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Obviously, the strategy that was being pursued before the war had some rather unintended consequences. We've also seen a major program produced by the Georgian government on the prospects for reintegration, a new approach to dealing with South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And Russia itself has also been forced into something of a reassessment, because the costs, as I alluded to in the reference to 99% of the budget of South Ossetia coming from the Russian Federation, that may not seem so much when one thinks about the small size of South Ossetia. But certainly this has added to Russia's burdens in the North Caucasus, and also added to some real complications there. Because what we've seen in the wake of, in particular, the recognition by Russia of Abkhazia's independence, is a spur to pan-Cherkess sentiment in the North Caucasus. The Abkhaz are part of the broader Cherkessian ethnic group, and they have a long history, obviously, of antagonism with the Russian state dating back several centuries. And there has, in fact, been a revival of the nationalist movement of the Cherkess. Most of the Cherkess now live in what was parts of the Ottoman Empire in Turkey and Jordan and other parts of the Middle East. But there's a real stirring of Cherkessian nationalism in the North Caucasus, which has been given even more of an impetus by the recognition of Abkhazia. So Russia finds itself actually also in a very difficult situation and may not, in fact, want to see things be revived in terms of return to violence. So the big questions in looking forward for the United States really are here, is how do we prevent the unravelling of this situation once again against this backdrop of a new dynamic? What the war in Georgia showed us in 2008 was that we were not dealing with frozen conflicts in the Caucasus by any stretch of the imagination. There's a real dynamic here. There's been a lot of concerns now about Nagorno-Karabakh. And you had here on Friday at OSI Tom Duval talking about his new book on the Caucasus, and somebody who's watched Nagorno-Karabakh very closely and is extremely concerned, along with many other observers, that in the wake of what happened in Georgia, there's a real risk of this conflict flaring up in a really meaningful way. In fact, it flares up all the time. There are constant clashes on the line of contact between the Azeris and the Armenians. But how then can one create an effective regime to restrain violence? One of the biggest contentious issues right now is about the militarization or demilitarization of the region in the wake of the war. The United States is being accused by the Russian government of rearming the Georgians, which is not in fact happening. And the supporters of Georgia are accusing the United States of imposing an arms embargo on Georgia. So really the United States can't win on that score in either way. But this is a real issue now in US and Russian relations. And every time there's a statement from the Russian government tends to say, we know the United States is doing this, clearly making a line just in case there's any thought of providing Georgia with any military assistance. So a lot of questions here about the United States' interests, what the United States' role is now in the region and in relations with Georgia, particularly with the EU now involved and with all this new dynamic. And what will the region look like in another 15 years from now is, for me, a major question. When we think we're 15-plus years out from the beginnings of the conflict in the early 1990s, actually we're more than that, really, aren't we? We're almost 20 years out. And Alex and Lincoln have really taken on a big task by trying to think about this new strategy for relations against this backdrop. So I'll turn it over to them, and I hope that you will all have some good questions and some thoughts about where we go from here.
Yona, thank you so much, and thank you to CEP for hosting this event. And really, what you got there was just a tour de force in terms of the scope of issues that are out there, as well as real analytical precision as to some of the problems. And I think Fiona has really hit the nail on the head when she talks about the competing narratives of the war and how that's framed our responses to and different understandings of what to do about this. And actually, Lincoln has a piece in Survival about the need for a new narrative on Georgia's part, and maybe he can talk about that during his time. I want to talk a little bit about the origins of this project and this report that you see in front of you. After the war, Lincoln and I were approached by a Smith Richardson Foundation and asked whether we would consider establishing a timeline of the events in August and what had happened. And we answered politely, thanks, but no thanks. There's actually a Swiss bureaucrat who's doing the definitive job on this, and you know, this isn't the kind of project we want to be involved with. But then we thought about this a little bit and said, this actually might be the chance not to do a timeline, but to do something that's forward-looking. And so we took the proposal to SRF, you know, how should U.S. engagement with Georgia be structured? How should it proceed? And what are the difficult issues that needs to be tackling, that needs to be tackled? Lincoln and I, from the outset, have been convinced that there are a lot of commonalities that the U.S. and Georgia have, and these take up all the oxygen. These take up all the discussion. What doesn't get discussed, rather, or analyzed is what we regard as some of the problem issues. Issues that need to be solved, need to be addressed honestly, need to be worked, need to be governed. And so we decided to write a report not on U.S.-Georgia relations in general, but take four issues that we thought were compelling, that touch upon different aspects of the relationship, of Georgia's territorial conflicts, of the neighborhood in general, and really analyze those and try to come up with concrete recommendations for those. And the four issues are what to make of this new U.S.-Georgia Charter of Strategic Partnership, two, the issue of what should U.S. and European policy be towards Abkhazia and South Ossetia, three, what is the relationship between democracy and stability in Georgia, and four, what have been the economic and perhaps more importantly political consequences of the aid and reconstruction package to Georgia after the war. So we're focusing our analysis on what we think are these four important issues. I'll discuss the first two. Lincoln will discuss the second two and offer some concluding remarks. So the U.S.-Georgia Charter of Strategic Partnership. This, some would say quite cynically, was the previous administration's goodbye gift to the Georgian government, that this was signed in January 2009 during the presidential transition, and that essentially our initial reaction was that this might be locking in the U.S. Into certain defense commitments that might prove to be imprudent. After spending some time now analyzing the charter, talking to people, looking at it in practice, I think both Lincoln and I have changed our minds on this. This initial gut reaction we had about the charter has actually now gone in the opposite direction. We see this as really a very positive development in the relationship. The charter structures U.S.-Georgian relations across four different working groups that encompass certain issue areas. Those are economics and energy, two, security and defense, three, democracy, and four, people-to-people exchanges and contacts. And so we have regular meetings along these working groups discussing these topics on the U.S. level. They also tend to have some interagency representation. And we think that in general, this is a good model for institutionalizing relations. Now, there are a couple of analytical points I would make about the charter. There are lots of charters out there, by the way, of sort of strategic cooperation and partnership, and they greatly vary in their content, in their commitments, in their various sort of compositions. So, for instance, the U.S. also enjoys one with Ukraine, but the Ukrainian one is very different than the Georgian one. And we sort of identify two particular features I think are distinct in the U.S.-Georgia charter. One is its asymmetry of defense commitments, and two is the emphasis on democracy in the document. So just talk about those a little bit. What we see in the charter is an attempt to delineate the nature of the security partnership with Georgia. And what's really fascinating about the document is that explicitly Georgia's or engaged security cooperation with Georgia is framed in terms of NATO obligations and in terms of commitments about Afghanistan. There is nothing in this document that commits the United States to the territorial defense of Georgia. In the course of our interviews and our discussions, we found that the security partnership was presented quite differently in certain segments, especially in, within Tbilisi. That is, some government officials, either willfully or not, were actually talking about an alliance commitment contained in the document that's actually not there, right? So it's not only the question of sort of what's in here, it's how this document is sort of presented Within the two publics, I think that that's of importance here, and sometimes it is mischaracterized. So a lot of the document is about Georgia's commitment to NATO, its commitment to ISAF, to Afghanistan, and so forth, but there's very little here committing the U.S. to supporting Georgia, rearming Georgia, defending Georgia. The other remarkable thing about this is the emphasis on democracy. Democracy permeates each one of these topics, each one of these working groups, and the real emphasis on this, to a degree that doesn't inform the Ukrainian charter, actually doesn't even inform the Baltic ones, which is viewed as one of the precursors here. Now, anytime you say, well, what good is this thing, right, this charter, this document, you have to ask the counterfactual, what would U.S.-Georgian relations look like without it? And this is really one of the areas which Lincoln and I sort of initially, I think, cut a little bit against the grain when in an article for Washington Quarterly a couple of years ago, we talked about the extreme personalization of relations that had developed between the U.S. and the Georgian government. In other words, the charter seeks to institutionalize relationships into predictable working groups as opposed to relying on personal friendships at the highest level of governments, because in some cases, those personal friendships also contributed to mixed messages going out to the Georgian government about what they should and shouldn't do in the fateful events that led up to August 2008. Secondly, having U.S. policy towards Georgia grounded in this kind of document, framed in this document, avoids form shopping on the part of certain Georgian interests. That is, this tendency to play off DOD versus the State Department versus Congress versus institutes and think tanks and so forth can be partially mitigated by grounding the relationship in these predictable forms with clear goals. And, you know, I'll give you a good example right now. This debate over whether Georgia should be rearmed, and Fiona is absolutely right, the U.S. actually can't win on this issue because they're accused of doing two completely contradictory things. So I think U.S. concerns over rearming Georgia gets to certain credibility in the Georgian leadership regarding what they would do with these weapons, a sense that they're... If not necessarily to be trusted, that they haven't demonstrated a measure of responsibility being able to handle these kinds of armaments. I would say, too, that there's also possibly a governance issue at stake here in terms of these armaments. Those of you who read Eurasianet will have seen that 22 executives indicted in January 2010 under the FCPA Act were allegedly part of a ring of arms dealers who conspired with the Georgian Ministry of Defense officials to cook the books so that their deals were marked up 20% over real cost, with the Georgian side getting 10%, the U.S. side giving 10%. So I think in the whole arms sales, I think we have legitimate security concern, but I think we also have a legitimate governance issue that's out there. So part of what the charter does is it tries to get on the U.S. side and the Georgia side everyone on the same page regarding what the goals are. And the security goals are a delicate line to tread, but I think the charter does it quite well, that the U.S. will assist Georgia in terms of fulfilling its multilateral obligations, but it will not commit troops or weapons to Georgia for its own territorial defense, because that has the potential to draw the U.S. into a proxy conflict in the Caucasus, which would be a disaster for everyone. Second issue I want to talk about is what should Western policy towards Abkhazia be? One of the things that really the war revealed was that the West had not only lacked a policy towards Abkhazia and South Ossetia, it hadn't really thought about having a policy towards Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Policy before had been adopting Tbilisi's policy, one of recognizing Georgia's sovereignty and territorial integrity, which we still do, but B, isolating Abkhazia and South Ossetia, right? The term frozen conflict was also synonymous with an isolated state. And this isolation, I think, has proven to be quite counterproductive. One of the things we have to realize, and this became obvious to us when we were in Abkhazia this year versus 2 months before the war broke out, is just how much the situation in the ground in Abkhazia has changed because of the war. Prior to the war, the big concern in Abkhazia was security. Security against possible Georgian aggression. And the sort of stereotypical images that they had was of sort of President Saakashvili anxious to sort of invade, reintegrate the sort of territory by force and so forth. This time around, what really struck us, we would go 20 minutes, half an hour into interviews, Georgia would never even come up. There's a sense that because of the recognition of Russia, and sort of the creation of sort of bilateral ties, that Abkhazia has moved on from the security issue. They feel secure. They have a Russian commitment to its defense. They're getting on with the business of building their state, right? That's how they feel. In fact, we were almost victims of these aspirations of statehoods when we found out that, you know, after months of sort of planning this carefully orchestrated trip, a Nicaraguan delegation was in town, and with all the pomp and circumstance, Nicaragua is one of four countries in the world that recognizes Abkhazia, that we actually might not get our meetings because of all the protocol that went with state-to-state visits. You know, our view was that if you're really an independent country, you can, you know, handle a Central American delegation and two U.S. academics on the same day, right? It shouldn't stretch your resources too far. But in any case, Abkhazia is in a very different way. And what's, I think, fascinating analytically is it's traded what we could term as sort of de facto autonomy as an unrecognized state to now they have recognition from Russia, but they're certainly not autonomous. They become almost a de facto part of the Russian Federation. Right? So under these quote-unquote bilateral agreements, many of which we detail in the report, you see Abkhazia being integrated into Russia itself in a way that it wasn't before. So part of what we view as imperative is to try and offer Sukhumi a different way. They're not going back to Georgia in the near term. Right? This is just not fathomable. At the same time, they are concerned about this Russian domination, about this Russian annexation, de facto annexation. So what we propose is sort of a third way of offering Abkhazia engagement without recognition. In other words, we're not going to recognize you, and we think these sort of competitive recognitions are bad for the international sovereignty system and so forth, but at the same time, we need to end Abkhazia's isolation. That's been actually quite destructive, and part of the cause of this competitive clientelism, U.S. and Georgia on one side, Russia, Abkhazia on the second. So the international community, we believe, the EU and the U.S. should reach out to Abkhazia. They should do things like focus, especially on the societal level, people-to-people contacts, educational exchanges, study tours, focus on promoting business links, both small and more sort of IFI-type projects, and B, really try and work with Abkhazia's civil society. Yes, Abkhazia has a civil society. It may not be as robust and developed as certain other countries, but we see space there for environmental concerns, for journalist type of concerns, for minority rights type of concerns, for the different diasporas that are currently in Abkhazia, and so forth. And the idea behind this, again, is that both the EU and Washington need to do something to stop what's becoming just the rapid swallowing up of Abkhazia by Russia, offering a different way. The status issues are going to be very difficult, and if they are ever resolved, right, they're going to be resolved in a matter of quite a few years. Nothing's going to happen in the short term. So in the meantime, we need more integration between Abkhazia, and especially Abkhazia. South Ossetia is a little bit of a different story, and the outside world, not less of it. How does this strategy relate to the Georgian government's new strategy? And this has been the subject of real debate, some concerns from the Georgian State Ministry of Reintegration. Basically, our view on this is that Abkhazia and the West should have certain contacts that are not necessarily mediated by Tbilisi and not necessarily mediated by the Georgian State Ministry for Reintegration, right? That there may be circumstances in which we should have joint Abkhaz and former residents of Abkhazia doing cooperative programs together, as the Georgian strategy says. But we should also have the other type too, right? That for the Abkhaz side, the sort of this particular sort of ministry in Tbilisi for them signifies that they want to take over Abkhazia, right? This is a ministry that they don't trust. And so I think we need to bring a balance of the two. Again, Tbilisi is very much against this. We see this as inevitable. Just to give you a little bit of current events type update as to the momentum of the strategy, we see signs that the EU is adopting this policy, or a very similar policy, this engagement without recognition. That they see this, they've gotten now consensus amongst the EU members and see this as a sensible way for the EU to engage with the region, especially having an office of the South Caucasus allows them to avoid some of the legal implications of dealing with Abkhazia or South Ossetia in the future. I don't think anything's going to be that ambitious, but it's going to be low-level, gradual attempts to forge some of these contacts. In the U.S., this is much more controversial, right? And we see varying debates, all sorts of legal and political arguments being thrown against the adoption of this. We also see Georgia itself lately pushing Congress to pass a bill on referring to Abkhazia and South Ossetia as occupied territories. Now, I think that's a really interesting debate, an interesting proposition. We can talk about that in Q&A. What would it mean to designate something as an occupied territory? I think actually it would have certain unintended consequences that perhaps haven't been thought through. But this idea of what to do now regarding Western policy towards the breakaway territories is very much being formulated, and we're happy to be part of a debate. So Lincoln will finish things off.
Thanks, Alex. And thank you, Fiona, and thank you, OSI, for hosting us here. I just want to mention that Alex and I have a piece in the current edition of the Washington Quarterly, which is available online, which fleshes out this proposal about engagement without recognition. So if you want more information, you could go to their website and read it. You go to the newsstand and buy it. That would be great, too. The two issues I want to talk about a little bit are the U.S. post-war assistance to Georgia and democracy, democratic development, and why that's important. And the reason we divide this presentation this way is because these are the two sections I wrote, and these are the two sections. Those are the two sections that Alex wrote. And when we sat in the cafe and decided who was going to write what section, I was frankly a little bit bummed because I thought that assistance wasn't that interesting, and I wasn't sure, you know, what I had to say about it. In retrospect, I think it's the most interesting of the four, and perhaps the most important. And I really did enjoy writing this. And unlike a lot of things I write about Georgia, I felt like I learned a lot in the process. So let me begin. Let me talk a little about this. First thing I would say is that when you think about foreign assistance to a country of the scale that was given to Georgia following the war, let me just begin. The origins of this assistance is there was a war in Georgia, there was a humanitarian damage, there was a need for humanitarian assistance to Georgia to mitigate the suffering of the Georgian people, particularly those who've been forced out of their homes, particularly with the winter coming, and given some of the infrastructural damage which had occurred in Georgia due to the Russian military. So that's the setting. We know that. We know that the current administration doesn't support Georgia because the person who pushed this through the Senate was Joe Biden, who's now the Vice President of the United States. So this was bipartisan in nature, and it was virtually unanimous. There's very little debate about this. Nobody really opposed this in Washington at the time. About $4 billion came into Georgia, $1 billion from the United States, another $3 billion from Europe. The United States overwhelmingly grants, the European money overwhelmingly loans. I'm simplifying a little bit. When you see assistance of this kind from the donor community, of this scale from the donor community, if you work, you know, around the world, the first thing you think is, my goodness, most of that money must have been stolen, right? And the second thing you think of is, we better check and see how much of that money was stolen. And what's interesting to me about Georgia is that most of that money was not stolen, right? And this continues a pattern of the Georgian government under President Saakashvili, who has taken this very radical approach that if you give him money to build a road, he builds a road, which is not how things are done in most parts of the world. It and certainly was not how things were done in Georgia under Saakashvili's predecessor. So the issue here is not, was the money stolen? Is there widespread high-level corruption of that nature, right? If you start probing that, you don't get a very interesting report. Now, so most of the money has been spent according to plan. However, it's not to say there's no corruption. The corruption, you can work on terms here, but what What has occurred in Georgia, which is consistent with the kind of Rose Revolution economic environment in general, is kind of crony capitalism, right? Contracts being pushed in one direction or another. We spoke to when we were in Tbilisi doing some research, folks from an OSI monitoring project who shared some anecdotes about this. So it's not perfect. There are people who got contracts and then backed away when the arm was put on them by the government that someone else was supposed to get that contract. But this is not a situation where the money is disappearing, right? I mean, I've worked in other countries, at other places, you know, where it's much more extreme. The real reason this assistance money is important and interesting are political in nature. And they're political, and they go to what I think is the real core of the U.S.-Georgia relationship. And let me just back up a little bit and say I began by saying this assistance was given as a response to the humanitarian problems created by the war. And that's true, but not all. That's all the truth, but it's not all of the truth. Part of the truth is that this money, by the time it got through Congress and was sent out, was also very, very deliberately given as a response to what had become the global economic crisis, right? Which is why Georgia did not get hit by the, there was a lag in Georgia being hit by the global economic crisis. Some would say it wasn't hit as hard as some of the countries in a similar situation. But this creates a complicated political relationship, right? It very much increases the dependence of Georgia on the United States, right? At the first 12 months following the war, once this money went through, $250 million in direct budget support from the Georgian budget was from the United States, roughly 15 tetri out of every lari, 15 cents out of every dollar that the Georgian government had was coming from the United States at that point. That's an awful lot of money. I mean, that's an awfully high proportion. That's the difference between a government collapsing and a government not collapsing. That's the difference between a state failing and a state not failing. Now, in fairness, I think the Washington policymakers, at least the one I was speaking to, thought that in August of 2008, the collapse of the Georgian state was not a good idea or a desired outcome. I won't speak for everybody in the room, but I kind of shared that view, that it was not something we wanted to see. But what needs to be taken into consideration is that when you bolster, to use a generous term, a state that way, it has a real political effect, right? To put it more clearly, you don't just prop up a state, you prop up a government, right? And the way that plays itself out in Georgia is that essentially there's an old, I think it was Plato or someone who said this, that when you lose a war and the economy goes in the crapper, your party gets voted out of office, right? That didn't happen in Georgia, right? And the reason it didn't happen in Georgia was because United American money prevented it from happening, right? So we became directly involved in Georgian politics. Now, there has been no presidential election since the war. But just for example, if you look at the most recent local elections where the ruling party in Georgia maintained control of every single local city council in Georgia and swept to a big victory in the Tbilisi mayor's race, the only direct mayoral election, the Georgian mayor of Tbilisi, Ugigi Ulava, campaigned on a lot of accomplishments which were paid for in some cases entirely by the United States government. Now, I don't fault Ugigi Ulava for doing that. That's called smart politics, right? That's how you run for office in any kind of a serious country. But to suggest that this was because of the unique ability of the United National Movement to govern is wrong. So we skewed the political outcomes there. The consequences were never faced. There was no, the accountability mechanism was removed because the net financial impact of the war for Georgia, frankly, was positive, right? The net human impact, obviously, was negative, right? People were killed. People lost their homes. People were displaced. Those are negatives, clearly. I'm not saying that. But it was not the economic catastrophe that it might have been. The real problem that this creates is that if we go back to Washington, right, where Alex started, and the discussion of Georgia-U.S. relations is that we talk about Georgia as a key ally, right? You hear this all the time. And I believe that that is aspirational. We would like Georgia to be a key ally, right? The problem in our relationship with Georgia is that we need to develop Georgia from being a key client to a key ally, right? Right now, the dependence is such that an alliance is not the right way to talk about that relationship, which is not to say that Georgia doesn't contribute and help the United States. Obviously, sending troops to Afghanistan to help with a NATO effort there is important, but the financial relationship is very skewed. And I suspect that policymakers both in Washington and Tbilisi would like to make that a little less skewed, would like to square that a little bit. But the problem is that the financial dependency is so great And changing that is going to be so difficult, right, that it's unlikely to change, which means that it will continue to be a client. And the other problem with having Georgia as a client is that the patron is held responsible for the actions of the client, right? We can listen, and Fiona can talk about being in Washington at the origins of the war and where it was viewed as a Russian-Georgia war, but you go to many countries in the region and you say, no, the United States really didn't tell Georgia to do this. Nobody believes you. Nobody believes you. And if it happens again, they'll believe us even less, right? So because of that patron-client relationship, we are perceived as being held responsible for what Georgia does, which is, I don't think, what anybody wants, and I don't think it's good for anybody. The question all this raises is, what's the exit strategy? How do we change this, right? Do we want to be in for $500 million a year in constant dollars forever in Georgia, for supporting Georgia, right? We jumped from about $150 million, if you count MCC money, Millennium Challenge Corporation money, and the other assistance, to about $550 million for the last couple of years. Do we want to sustain that level of assistance, given the politics I've just mentioned, given the domestic politics in the United States, which is not exactly demanding to spend more money on foreign assistance at that moment in our time, and given the complicated geopolitics, is that something we want to do? And if we don't, how do we handle this, right? Do we just cut it? Do we just say, sorry, you're going back to $150 million a year? I don't think we can do that quite so easily. I think the political impact, the economic impact in Georgia would be great. So if we make that kind of a cut, we have to be aware that it's going to have a real impact. And we're going to have to deal with that impact. We can't walk away from it. One of the things we talk about is, how do we phase this out? How do we have a phase down of this assistance so that we get back to a more normal level without kind of shocking the system too much in Georgia? Now, of course, the Georgian government behaving completely rationally, right, as any government would in its situation, sees its position as making sure those cuts aren't too dramatic, right? Which is why you have this intense Georgian lobbying effort, which again is completely rational, right? However, there's a certain irony to a situation where the United States is giving Georgia money to hire American lobbyists to press the American Congress to give Georgia more money, right? Because remember, at least 15 cents on the dollar is coming from the United States, or 15 tetri on the lari is coming from the United States. And we outline in the report just how much money is being spent on this lobbying effort. It's in one of the charts in the book, but I will tell you a story that when we were there, we were having a dinner with someone from Transparency International who was doing who was trying to bring this to the attention of the Georgian people, and she was told not to talk about this because it was national security information that couldn't be shared, right? This information, I actually, Matt, our research assistant, our very able research assistant, did the research on this, but he was a great guy and a great researcher, and didn't have to work too hard, right? This is on an open source website in the United States. You can get 5 minutes on a Google search. It's not that hard. It's deliberately open information because the American people have a right to know this, right? The suggestion that somehow the Georgian people didn't have a right to know that was really striking, but it does suggest that there is some concern in Georgia about that. Now, before we move on, I want to lay out a scenario, right? We go into 2013 when there's a presidential election, but now we're thinking 2012, there's a parliamentary election. Around 2011, the resistance goes from 550 to 150 million, which is an enormous shock to the Georgian economic system. And at that same time, the debt service from all the European debt balloons. It quadruples, I think, in proportion of the budget they're going to have to spend on debt service, thus creating an enormous economic problem for Georgia as they go into what could be a key election, which will be likely jeopardize any modest democratic reforms that may be made, put pressure on the government to do whatever they can to win that election, including postponing it, changing the Constitution, all of those things we're beginning to see, and create a very complicated domestic political situation where the one of the causal factors for that is what we do, right? One thing that we try to stress in here is that we're too deeply involved in Georgian politics to pull back and say, well, it's their problem, not ours, right? We've been in too deep for too long. So I want to move on and talk about democracy, but I begin by saying this. As Anthony pointed out when we were hoping that some of you would show up, it's a rainy Monday afternoon. It's kind of the first day of fall. We had this beautiful weekend. It's rainy. It's a little chilly out there. We have a tight pennant race in the National League West. There's a lot going on. And it occurs to me that I wouldn't take the subway from 116th Street to 59th Street to hear what Lincoln has to say about democracy in Georgia, because you've all heard it all, or up from 14th Street. So I'm going to try to say a few new things here that I've been thinking about lately. And one is that Georgia, I think, and one of my, I was talking about this with a couple of students at Columbia who are just back from Georgia who raised this point, but Georgia has reached an interesting equilibrium with regards to democracy, and with particular regards to elections within that. And that equilibrium is essentially the following. It's good enough for the West, right? It's good enough that the West is going to always say, oh, you could do this better, oh, you could do that better. They're not going to say much more of that. They've carved out a niche. You might call it, again, to use a technical term, the tallest building in Topeka niche, right? The most democratic country in the former Soviet Union outside of Ukraine and the Baltics, right? Much more democratic than all of its neighbors, but the democratic institutions are weak enough to ensure that the government will stay in power indefinitely, right? That's the equilibrium they've created. The challenge for the Georgian government is, can they maintain that equilibrium, right? Can they maintain that balance? The question for the United States is, what role should we have in helping them maintain that balance, or should we have a role? Now, this is not to say that everything is stagnant, because it's not stagnant. The notion that Georgia is an important democracy, which was still out there quite a bit when we began writing this project, is really outside of, you know, a handful of kind of think tanks, a handful of right of center foreign policy shops, not taken all that seriously anymore. I was in an interesting talk by an anthropologist, not a Georgia specialist, who casually referred to the authoritarian tendencies of the Georgian government, and everyone in the room, grad students, not Georgia experts, just kind of nodded their head as if you were talking about, you know, the Islamic tendencies of the Iranian government or something. I mean, nobody really questions that or pushes back against that, particularly in the scholarly world. But where does that go from here? Our relationship with Georgia is based on that narrative. And as that narrative just doesn't, it's not that it's a big lie, it's just that it's not really there anymore. What do we base that on? Now, some might say that, well, we don't have, if the narrative's gone, it makes it easier, right? We don't have to talk about democracy anymore. We can talk about our other interests. We can talk about NATO. I mean, in other words, their support for a NATO effort in Afghanistan. We can talk about, you know, the key strategic value of Georgia, which might be an equally bankrupt narrative. But I would argue that that's wrong. I would argue that in the case of Georgia, democracy is essential both for stability and for national security in Georgia. The best way to oppose, to push back against the threat created by Moscow, represented by Moscow, if you're in Tbilisi, is not by buying advanced weapons from the United States. We don't have enough advanced weapons to sell Georgia that can really defend itself from Russia, right? The way is to integrate into security alliances for which democracy is the price to pay. If you don't have it, you can't get in. It may not be sufficient, but it is absolutely necessary. It's also a stability strategy. And again, the evidence for this in Georgia is that in the roughly 6 years, almost 7 years that we've been backing a strongman regime in Georgia, right, we've seen violently dispersed riots in the streets, we've seen war, we've seen the country further dismembered, we've seen entire summers where the capital city has been kind of has been, you know, brought to a halt by widespread demonstrations. We've seen the crackdown of free media, people breaking into an independent television station and kind of breaking things up. We've seen this strange hoax causing an emergency, you know, panic that the Russians are reinvading. So it's not a story of great stability in Georgia, but it's a country where, like all countries, but probably more than some, where stability is absolutely imperative, right? And the argument could be made. I mean, you could clearly imagine that the scholars would sit around 30 years from now and say the reason that the Georgian government made that decision under difficult situations to start shelling was because there was too much pluralism. You could imagine that decision, that scholarship being made. And if you wrote enough academic literature around it, you could probably get tenure based on that. But it would still be nonsense, right? The far more likely that you can imagine saying, you know, if more opinions have been represented, if there had been more accountability, maybe they wouldn't have started that. Maybe somebody might have said, you know, this fake invasion on Amedi, not a great idea, right? Maybe somebody might have said, well, maybe we should listen to these demonstrators rather than crack down on them. So if we're serious about stability, democracy, we have to get serious about supporting democracy. And I want to leave with summing up what our two recommendations are. One is, or I guess three recommendations. One is stay engaged, right? And by stay engaged, not just provide funding for the Resistance for the United States, not just provide funding for various programs, developing civil society and this kind of thing, but provide those programs with political backup so that the messaging publicly from the United States is that this is important. Second thing is start early, right? We're now probably less than 2 years away from what will be the major national election in Georgia, right? That election, democracy is about more than elections, but in Georgia, elections are important. And to create a climate where a fair election is possible, the time to start is yesterday, right? Not tomorrow. And the last thing, again, to stress is to get away from this notion of, well, it's not their problem. Well, it's not their problem. It's not our problem. It's their country. Is a good liberal sentiment that's kind of been skewed to become a way of removing yourself from a position of responsibility when the questions get too tough. We're very deeply involved, right? Our money has propped up a government. Our money has prevented a government from being really held accountable by its voters. We can't just say, oh, it's not our problem anymore. I just want to make some concluding remarks. I can't see the clock in front of a watch, but I think it's about time to do that. First, the reality is that Georgia remains a low priority for this administration, right? This administration right now, outside of the very short-term political, electoral needs it faces, is focused on a battery of domestic issues, right, primarily, not least of which is the state of the American economy. And that will remain the most important thing that this administration does as long as they're in office. And then among foreign policy considerations, there are higher issues, right? Afghanistan, Iran, Mexico, these all spring to mind. So keeping Georgia low priority is not a tragedy. But thinking that as part of that, just to keep doing what you're doing is a mistake. That is, to not make any policy changes might solve the problems today, or might put off the problems for till tomorrow or the next day, but it doesn't make the problems go away. The potential for things to go wrong is real, and if they do go wrong, the impact on the United States could really, suddenly these could become real problems for us. And the way to prevent that from happening is to address these issues now before they become real problems. The last thing I would say is that we presented a presentation here where we talked about four different issues, but they're all related, right? If you get the assistance wrong, the impetus to have to pull back on democracy is going to be more. If that happens, the rhetoric around Abkhazia is going to get more warlike, more aggressive, which is going to make any engagement without recognition policy more of a problem, more difficult for us to pursue. If that happens, you're going to see more and more end runs around the strategic charter, right? So this has to be viewed holistically, even though that's not how we presented it today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Lincoln, and also Alex. I'd like to turn over to everybody here in the audience. Presumably you were all reading the report, if you hadn't read it already, as we were listening to. I saw a few of you turning to the pages anyway. But in any case, you don't have to ask questions related to the report. Alex and Lincoln have, as you can tell, have been studying this for a very long time and both spent a lot of time in Georgia. So I'd like to throw it open. And if I could ask, as Anthony said, to use the microphone, but if you could just introduce yourself briefly as well. For everybody who's going to be, I'm sure, listening with bated breath when we have the podcast later on, Anthony. Yeah? But no pictures, right? Or are you going to? No. Oh dear. Well, anyway, that's good then. So you won't have to worry about your appearance. So please anybody, speak at will. And if nobody's going to speak, I'm going to call on someone. Yes, please.
Graduated CIPA in 2009. I'm interested, well, and I understand your strategy, recognition without engagement without recognition is some kind of good idea for debate, but I'm wondering, would it be creating more problems for the future Abkhaz-Georgian relationship in terms of that bringing them back to the country and making Georgia sovereign as it should be today? So I'm interested, what kind of issues do you see that could create that will be problem for our future relationship with Abkhaz and South Ossetians? Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I can't stress enough that wars have consequences. This is the problem. It's not that the Georgian Ministry of Reintegration strategy is a bad strategy. It's that this would have been appropriate for 10 years ago. That in the current political climate, the issue is pretty much that the Abkhaz feel like they're building a state. They want nothing to do with cooperative relationships that are mediated by a ministry that's dedicated to gobbling them up. That's the problem. That's the essence of the dilemma. And the Abkhaz are very clear on this. They say, look, in 2005, we had nothing. We didn't even have real guaranteed sort of Russian support. And at that time, there was a proposal for some humanitarian measures to go to Abkhazia from the international community, and then they would be mediated by Tbilisi. We turned them down back then because we didn't see our future lying in Tbilisi. Why would we ever agree to this package now? So the strategy is simply not taken as a credible document. The Abkhaz regard the strategy as something that's intended for Western consumption regarding Georgia, and also that is meant to soften Tbilisi's international image as being uncooperative on this, right? So let's set that political aside. I think if both strategies technically set aside status issues, right? So I think the Georgian strategy, and I think, you know, that's a big deal. But at the back of that, you can't have lurking Abkhazia and South Ossetia will become part of Georgia in the future, right? Because that's exactly what trips them up. And I think the biggest challenge on the Georgian side is to take the independent preferences and aspirations. That doesn't mean to acknowledge their independence. I'm not saying we should do that. But to take the Abkhaz and South Ossetians as political actors, right? And to stop saying this line, they're always acting under the barrel of the gun, they're always doing what the Russians tell them to, because the minute you deny them agency, right, is the minute they say, you just don't understand us. And we'll go with Moscow. Moscow dominates us, but, you know, at least we have certain ceremonies, at least we have certain institutions. That's why the strategy is aimed to buy some time, to stop this Russian absorption. And then in the future, maybe there will be status talks, and maybe once the West has leverage over Abkhazia, once it has something it can take away from Abkhazia in terms of links and so forth, then maybe you can condition in the very far future certain status procedures on some of these instruments. But because we've isolated Abkhazia, the West has no leverage. It has nothing to take away, right? So this is the logic of the strategy. The only other thing I would say on this is, you know, sometimes you really are surprised by a set of comments that come out of a situation. And really, when we ask people, what in Abkhazia this time around, what's your greatest fear, right? What's your real sort of biggest sort of security concern? Just expecting that it would be, again, renewed hostility with Georgia or whatever. It wasn't that. It was really interesting. They said, what we fear is a Russian-Georgian rapprochement. Right? So how is that? Because if in 5-10 years' time, we're post-Putin and we're post-Saakashvili, because nothing's going to happen while those two are still involved in politics, if we ever get to the position, right, where this is no longer this personal animosity, we're scared we're going to be carved up by Georgia and Russia. So we're doing what we can, as quickly as we can, to make sure that we have some sort of viable state-like institutions before that happens. So Abkhazia is in a race against the clock as well, you see. So there's many different dimensions and intricacies to this, all very, very difficult and complicated.
If I could just briefly...
Yeah, please, yeah.
Briefly,
yeah.
I think that for the United States, if we're serious about restoring Georgia's territorial integrity, and, you know, the evidence is mixed on that, but if we are, the best way to achieve that is to stop talking about it, right? To recognize it's not going to happen. You know, when you send Joe Biden over, who says in a prepared text, it is a sad truth that Georgia cannot restore its territorial integrity through military means. That's a quote, right? How does that play in Suchumi? The inference is that, well, if you could win the war, that'd be great, right? And what our strategy, because of that, is not a bring Abkhazia back into Georgia strategy. Not because we think that's the wrong outcome, but because we don't think we can make that happen. We don't think the United States can make that happen. It's a buy some time strategy. It's a reduce Russian influence strategy, and it's a get some leverage strategy. And if we succeed in doing those things, then restoring Georgia's territorial integrity is back on the table. Until then, it's not really.
Let me just add a couple of things here, because this is one place where some of the metaphors and analogies that I mentioned before actually do work. I mentioned Cyprus, 1974, and the Turks. I mean, in many respects, this is where we've ended up in terms of our thinking about Cyprus in the same way, because for an awfully long time, the West basically isolated northern Cyprus, the Turkish Republic. There's no recognition. Venezuela and Nicaragua and all these places didn't even contemplate recognition. They're still only recognized by Turkey itself. Now, there's some differences there in terms of northern Cyprus was never completely convinced that it really wanted full-fledged independence, where a lot of Abkhazs seem to be the case. And there have been a lot of concerns in northern Cyprus about the influx of Turks from mainland Turkey coming to settle there. And as we'll recall, on the Annan Plan, which was how many years ago now? 5 years ago? It's kind of a long time ago now. It was actually the Turkish Cypriots who, after many years of outreach to them, actually voted in favour of some form of confederation, of unification again with Greek Cyprus, only to be rejected by the Greek Cypriots. Because what happened there, of course, is a sort of change in international circumstances. The Greek Cypriots were able to get themselves into the EU and then basically have a much larger carrot. But it turns out, of course, the Greek Cypriots then thought that they could use this in an absolutist way to sort of force terms on their Turkish former co-brethrens. And in a way, that's how many people in Abkhazia saw what Georgia was trying to do. There was a belief in Abkhazia that Georgia really wanted to get into NATO so that it could force the issue on Abkhazia, to sort of basically kind of reincorporate Abkhazia back into Georgia on Georgia's terms. So there was this gets into the point of view that you were referencing about this great suspicion on the part of the Abkhaz and great concerns there. But there are some lessons from the Cypriot case, although it didn't exactly end all that well. It isn't over yet. We're still talking about breaking the isolation of Turkish Cyprus. There are ongoing negotiations about opening the ports and getting the Turks and the Greek Cypriots as well as Greece more active there. The problem is, I guess, from the point of view of Tbilisi, of all of this takes a lot of time. I mean, we're talking about 1974, and I think it's the timelines which becomes the greatest concern for everyone. Because I do remember, in the sense of Tbilisi, in the run-up to the war in 2008, was there was a great sense of time running out. And when you would talk to Georgian officials, there was a sense of, what, we're going to be like the Palestinians? We're going to be waiting, you know, forever for a resolution of, you know, these issues. We're going to be 60 years, 50 years, 40 years, 30 years. And the Abkhaz are obviously thinking the same. So this is where we get into the sort of timeline issues. But there are a lot of parallels with other conflicts that are both useful, but also at the same time, I think, rather worrying for the various sides of the of this issue.
I mean, those are fabulous points, especially this idea of the timeline, because, you know, as Lincoln has a chapter entitled "This Governance by Adrenaline" in his book, right? Short timelines have been a way of doing business of sort of this government, and the necessary domestic political work for what a true reconciliation would look like just hasn't been done. There's always talk about, oh, the IDPs will be home by New Year's, right? Mm-hmm. This is a medium-term strategy. Medium-term? 3 to 5 years, right? That to talk in terms of decades, I guess, you know, yields no political benefits, especially to this ruling regime, and something that they're not used to doing. So the domestic preparation in terms of preparing the Georgian public, you know, what this process will look like, still has been laid out, even with the new Georgian strategy through sort of cooperation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
It's deeply tied to Georgian domestic politics, obviously, right? I mean, as if, you know, the economy is stalling, the democratic reforms aren't happening, you keep upping the ante on these regions. And that creates a climate where it's very hard to make any real progress. And that was certainly the climate in mid-2008. And it hasn't, I mean, I think it's gotten a little better, but it hasn't gotten, you know, qualitatively better. It hasn't changed dramatically since then.
Mom, sorry, you've waited a while.
Yes, thank you. My name is Dr. Polner, and I'm president of Cinema Verite International, Inc., and I've made all documentaries all over the former Soviet Union, and I've lectured at SIPA. just come from 116th Street, actually. But anyway, my question to you is, and I came in late, so perhaps you covered this, but what seems to have been left out of this discussion is the Russian bear. The Russian bear has basically won in that part of the world. As you've noted yourself, Obama's direction is concentrated on domestic issues. They're well aware of that. They have been incredibly empowered. And what are they going to do next? I was in Volgograd when the attack occurred in Tbilisi. Volgograd is the former Stalingrad, and I could not help but think of all those Germans marching along the steppe towards Volgograd. So what will Russia do next? It's totally empowered. There's no reason why it shouldn't do something. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think this is very interesting, this idea that Russia has somehow made a statement and become empowered by the situation in the Caucasus. I don't really see it that way. I mean, I think certainly that was the popular media reaction immediately following, right? That this was a line in the sand, no more Kosovos, no more double standards, no more the West meddling around. These are going to be the consequences. But as Fiona talked about, you have now taken on, congratulations, you are now the owners of two completely non-profitable provinces, one of which you've committed to support at this 99% level, the other, Abkhazia, which you're supporting at $120 million a year over 3 years kind of thing. Plus, the long-term ramifications, and there were divisions in the Russian intel community over recognizing Abkhazia and South Ossetia, remain to be seen, especially in terms of their effects in the Northern Caucasus. The Northern Caucasus is spiraling out of control for Russia, and it is not clear at all why the South Ossetians get to have a state that's recognized by Moscow, but all of these other groups and members of the Russian Federation don't, right? So I actually think how this plays out for Russia over the medium term is quite interesting and up for debate. I think it's in a lot of different parties' interest to talk about this narrative of Russian ascendancy. And let me give the Kyrgyzstan example, right? When Lincoln and I were in Tbilisi, post-events in Kyrgyzstan, it almost seemed as if some circles in the Georgian government were elated with this development, right? This is what can happen in Kyrgyzstan. It's exactly the same situation. Moscow did it in Bishkek. They can do it here. And of course, you know, to me, the kind of lesson about Kyrgyzstan is that, you know, just as in 2005, I think a lot of organizations took inappropriate credit for sort of, you know, the dismantling of the Akayev regime, so too a lot of organizations in Moscow took credit for the collapse of sort of Bakiyev. But these are very different situations, and are you seriously comparing the Georgian state to the fragility and basket case and kleptocracy that had become under Bakiyev? So you have to be careful with these analogies about Russia's resurgence. One final point. A few days after the recognition, President Medvedev went to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Dushanbe, thinking that he would collect recognitions from this forum, right? Certainly thought he could get the Kazakhs, probably the Kyrgyz and so forth. And instead, he got a very strongly stern statement put together behind the scenes by Beijing that, you know, although, you know, Russia justifiably acted in terms of these sort of provocations and so forth, we recognize the territorial integrity of existing sovereign states, right? So Russia got rebuffed, and it also got rebuffed in the CSTO. So that kind of traction over sort of who's next, demonstration effects, this kind of thing, just hasn't played out with the intensity that I think we expected in the beginning.
I would just add a couple of other things. I think the U.S. is aware of the potential threat by Russia. The challenge here is to create a Russia relationship that is the terms of which are set by Moscow, not Tbilisi. Right? We came closer to a shooting war with Russia in 2008 than we did any time since Berlin. Mm-hmm. Right? That may not be something. We may want to call those shots ourselves rather than have that set by a client that we can't fully control.
Okay, I'd just like to comment, though, that you have basically left out how Obama is seen in that part of the world. As you specifically noted yourself, he appears to have very little interest. And given that state, that's, you said it, I didn't, okay. Given that state, then Russia, which has never been a very quiet agent, is probably going to get involved in something else, what it's going to be or what have you. But again, it takes two to tango, and that's how Obama is seen. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me just actually just say something just very quickly here, because certainly the view that you've just expressed here was, I mentioned at the very beginning, probably before you came in, that there were, you know, a lot of fears immediately after the war broke out in August 2008, including that this was 1939 all over again and that Russia was Tbilisi today, Tallinn tomorrow. There was a lot of concern that this was the beginning of a sort of revanchist Russian resurgence across the whole of the former Soviet space, and that the Baltic states could be next, Crimea and Ukraine, a lot of concerns there. Well, I think what none of us really anticipated was actually the impact of the financial crisis on Russia. And there was a lot of euphoria in Russia in those heady days of immediately after August 2008, and let's just say they had a hangover by October. Because there was a lot of anticipation that there would be blowback, political, from the war in Georgia, and that actually didn't happen. I mean, as we know, everyone was on vacation. We were trying to watch the Beijing Olympics. It took President Sarkozy to actually move in because nobody else was willing to do so. We talked about the EU monitoring mission being set up. A whole response that, you know, the Russians did, frankly, think was quite weak. But then they were really hard hit by the economic crisis. And I actually went to Moscow in October 2008 and was really struck by the complete shock that you were talking about, the inability of people to meet because the delegation was in from Nicaragua. When I was there in October, people were fleeing from the conference I was supposed to be because they were in a panic, running around wondering, you know, what was going to happen to the Russian economy. And this has been really the kind of change there. So the kinds of fears that you're raising now have been completely reversed. I just came back from Moscow 10 days ago, where it's not just the US that has reset the relationship and is sort of thinking about domestic issues and a different view of its foreign policy, but the Russians are talking about the importance of great relations with the EU, with the United States, this new high-tech venture in Skolkovo, the new kind of Silicon Valley. They've entered into this with MIT, with a whole host of U.S. Commercial enterprises. There's an awful lot of talk about the importance of the relationship with the United States now, the importance of the relationship with Europe, and it's all about really the economic downturn and really thinking about how to turn this around. So there's been a really sobering effect. I think the Russians realize it would be incredibly bad for business if they did anything like this again. So, I mean, in many respects, it's more dependent on where oil prices go, how the global economy bounces back, rather than it is on maybe perhaps the predilections of some people who might be still having some thoughts about perhaps reversing the tide of some of the things that we were talking about. So let's just say the Russian bear is worrying where its honey is right now, rather than perhaps about what it might be otherwise chasing. Anyway, I pulled away from this, but I was just very struck by the complete change in a two-year period from where the Russians thought they were in August 2008. It was really kind of the bubble, not just on an economic level, but also on a political level. That was kind of like the furthest point, and the bubble burst not too long after it. Anthony, you were trying to ask a question here. Yeah.
Thank you, all three, for your presentations. I wanted, first of all, to come back to this idea, especially Fiona referring to her training as historian, about the miscalculation, because it seems really that this is a story of at least two miscalculations, one on the part of Georgia and another one on the part of the United States. The outsized generosity of the United States, both in financial terms and subsequently in diplomatic ones, even with this somewhat odd charter, seems to suggest the operations of a guilty conscience of some kind, that there was some kind of wink or nod that was given. And you said, Lincoln, I think it was Lincoln who said that you looked into this. But that kind of generosity, you know, also seems to be, when reminiscent of getting a do-over for certain other historical episodes to which Fiona in her catalog didn't allude, like 1953 in East Germany or 1956 in Hungary, which easily might have been part of that peroration of historical parallels, because here is a chance where we couldn't do it, and in those instances we couldn't really send assistance. But here we did. So, and Fiona, you were in government at the time. It'd be interesting to know how that miscalculation came about, what they heard. The other question that I wanted to ask is that, you know, looking at this document now, having let it sit for a couple of months, you know, one takes a look at it and thinks that this is a document that the title and presentation of which is a kind of artifact of the pre-war period, where the idea of a U.S.-Georgian relations placed so squarely as a matter of importance, now, after the reset, seems somehow like a quaint kind of historical episode. And the bigger question to which a number of you have been referring is really about not what's the future of U.S.-Georgian relations, what's the future of Georgia in the frame of reset U.S.-Russian relations. And I was wondering if you could reflect maybe on that one as well.
I'll take a stab at the reset, maybe.
I'll take a stab at both.
Yeah. No. Anthony always, always asking the tough questions. I think you're right. There is a certain element that even talking about the U.S.-Georgian special relationship is sort of an artifact before the war. One of the things that happened over the course of the years following the Rose Revolution is that Georgia became a much hyped about success case of supposed democratic transformation. And the previous administration, of course, was not popular globally, and the sort of freedom agenda in general that was used to justify Iraq, justify some of the other colored revolutions and so forth, wasn't terribly popular either. And so U.S. needed success stories, and Georgia fit the bill perfectly. This was a young country that had gone from being really a fractured state governed governed by essentially sort of, you know, warlords kind of thing, to this young, vibrant, Western-looking democracy. And that bought them a lot, right? And Georgian officials started to realize that presenting themselves in this way as a successor in Washington, D.C., allowed them to punch a little bit above their weight, right? So we had this discussion in Tbilisi, and sort of we made the point, it's not that the Obama administration, I think, necessarily, wants to sell Georgia out. It doesn't have the same emotional resonance or tie to Georgia because of the politics surrounding Obama's election versus Bush's administration. Now, regarding how does this play into the Russian-U.S. Reset, this is really fascinating, right? And a lot of commentators in Georgia from the very beginning saying, the U.S.-Russia reset, you're selling us out as part of the reset, right? You're trading us and our aspirations as part of this big, oh, now we're friendly with Moscow kind of thing, which is, I think, a mischaracterization of both where Georgia's position lies and a mischaracterization of the reset. The truth is that Georgia's NATO aspirations are pretty much dead for the moment, right? That it's not up to the United States to get Georgia into NATO, right? You have to sort of convince Germany, Italy, France that you could be a credible member, right? I mean, you know, the U.S. is not going to be able to sort of bully those decisions just as they weren't in Bucharest. That's number one. So in there's very little additional in terms of sort of international institutional architectures that the U.S. can offer Georgia, even if there weren't a reset. But the purpose of the Russia-U.S. reset is not to make nice with Moscow. As the crafters of the strategy have pointed out, it's to get things that we need from Moscow, right? And the two number one issues that were focused on was the start
Second, START arms control treaty, right? And number two, getting Russian cooperation on Afghanistan, with the, you know, setup of the Northern Distribution Network, supply routes, and then this kind of thing. Those were the two main asks. So this administration perceived the reset as a way of getting Russian cooperation on those two issues. The Georgia issue is a level below, and it's a complicating one on the horizon, right? It's one that's going to be revisited at some point, whether it's in a year or 2 years or so forth. I think the intention is, and we'll see how this plays out, the intention is by having built up some set of sort of cooperative history, right, that at least you can talk about these issues versus where relations were in August 2008, where they had plummeted, that, you know, reflexively Moscow said cold, we said hot, they said white, we'd say black, I mean, this kind of thing. Now, is there a dialogue that can bridge the bridge the positions on Georgia? I'm not sure. But that's the logic of the reset, anyway.
I think your first question, was there a wink or a nod? Is there a guilt going on? I mean, when I first started looking into this, I would ask a lot of people in Georgia, you know, why are we giving this support? And I used a more delicate phrase. I said, is this hush money, right? Is this kind of take the money, go away, leave us alone, we screwed up, we don't really want to be in this anymore? And the answer I resoundingly got on both sides was no. So I tend to think I was wrong. It's not hush money. I think it is a little bit easier to give the money than to give whatever kind of military support might have been people in Georgia might have wanted. It is easier to give the money. And one wonders whether if this war had happened in November of 2008, say after the election or something, after the economy, if the economy had really gone south in June, it's very hard to imagine this money coming through. This money is the geopolitical equivalent of the new Yankee Stadium, right? It's the economy of 2 years ago. It doesn't make sense in the current economy. I do think there was a wink and a nod, but I think the reason, in other words, I think that there were people in the American leadership who were saying, yes, do it, it's all right. But the reason, and we addressed this in our Washington Quarterly article at the end of 2008, and the reason is there's so much back channeling. And the Georgian government was doing so much forum shopping that, of course, somebody said yes. If you ask me who, I don't know. I have my ideas. I'm not going to say them here for the record. But, of course, someone said yes. And if you're waiting for someone to say yes, you're going to get a yes. Now, if you run it through the rational question of who's saying no, so if the Secretary of State and the Ambassador are saying no, and a special assistant, somebody saying yes, you might want to weigh that differently. But I think there was that. I think this does feel a little bit quaint, and if this would feel more quaint if this were, you know, on the front page of the New York Times, right? In other words, it's a report on Georgia because, not because Georgia is the most important issue facing the United States. I don't think we suggest that here at all. In fact, we do the kind of professionally not very wise thing of saying, in fact, Georgia's not as important as everyone thinks. But given that, getting the relationship right is important. I think it is a foreign policy success for the Obama administration if they, let's say they serve 8 years, where at the end of those 8 years they say, you know what, Georgia never made the front page. I think that's a foreign policy success, but if you just pursue the status quo, you won't achieve that success.
Yeah, let me just add something to this, just picking up on where Lincoln left off. I mean, it's really important to get this right because it almost was the most important foreign policy issue at one point. Ironically, when I was in the National Intelligence Council, after Iran and Afghanistan, we were spending most time on Georgia at different junctures. And it wasn't just in August 2008, it was in the whole run-up to this. And really, this was because of the issue that Alex was talking about, because the relationship with Russia had deteriorated so dramatically that we were basically on a trajectory for confrontation from a period extending probably back to the beginning of the Bush administration. I mean, really, the low point in U.S.-Russian relations was, as I mentioned at the very beginning, the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. And frankly, it was from that low point, it was downhill even further after that. Because we actually, the miscalculation, getting back to Anthony's question here, was that we didn't think that somehow that there would be any consequences from really letting the relationship deteriorate so severely. That the idea that one could get into a screaming match of indefinite duration with Russia would somehow just keep on going like that. I mean, I literally heard in various meetings at different pines, they'll scream and scream, but nothing will happen. And that was actually a huge miscalculation. That we were, you know, there does become a point when you're screaming at each other that one person decides to well, I mean, unless we have proper counseling, you know, sometimes we can kind of find ways out of this. But one tends to find that in playground-type confrontations, eventually, if people are screaming at each other enough, there'll be a temptation for one to lash out. And that's basically where we got to. But we weren't just screaming the US and Russia at each other. We were in a multiple screaming match. Because, again, another of the miscalculations was that the Georgians thought that it would be better for them if the US and Russia were screaming at each other. We tended to think that the Russians and Georgians screaming at each other wouldn't have much of a consequence. And we were forgetting that the Georgians, the South Ossetians, the Abkhazians were all screaming at each other as well. So we got this incredibly complicated dynamic where everybody literally wanted to up the ante. And that's basically where we got to in August 2008. The United States miscalculated the dynamic of between South Ossetia and Georgia. There'd actually been some real concerns about an escalation in the relationship between Georgia and Abkhazia just months beforehand, where the U.S. had actually taken some really serious diplomatic moves to tamp things down, and then everyone had forgotten that South Ossetia was still out there. And I think even the Russians themselves were actually surprised by what happened, because they tended to sometimes buy into their into the larger narrative of South Ossetians being their proxies. I mean, there's a lot of stories here about what really happened on the ground in South Ossetia in the whole week leading up, who made decisions to do what. And I think we'll never probably know, but in actual fact, the situation was extraordinarily complex. And that's why I made my own analogies back to July 1914. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, a shot in Sarajevo in the preceding period would have sparked off this cascade of different events where everybody miscalculated and nobody really knew what they were doing. And I think that's really where we almost basically reached the situation that Lincoln mentioned. We got very close, closer than we had done in decades, to actually engaging directly with Russia. In a series of further miscalculations could easily have triggered off at least an exchange of shots. You may recall that we actually had an agreement because of the various relationships with Georgia to bring the Georgian troops back from Afghanistan, from Iraq, if there was an outbreak of conflict. And that was one of those moments where one can foresee or could have at least envisaged that there could have been a misunderstanding about the U.S. bringing Georgian troops back from Iraq in the middle of a conflict and easily getting into some kind of exchange with the Russians that was misunderstood, leading to exchange of fire. So we were in a very difficult situation here. And I think what it did was sober everyone up. After this ridiculous, frankly, situation where we all miscalculated, everybody took a step back and decided that it was time for a reset. So we didn't just have a reset of the U.S.-Russian relationship. We've had multiple resets across the board. Now, the question is, now, where do we go from here? And as I think we've discussed, we have really actually a totally different dynamic now. And I think where we are now will certainly not be where we will be in the next 5 or 10 years. And a lot of the things that you've discussed here still raise an awful lot of questions about what would be the appropriate kind of relationship between the U.S. And Georgia, just as what is the appropriate relationship between the U.S. and Russia, and then what is the appropriate relationship between the Georgians, the South Ossetians, and Abkhazians. I was frankly surprised to hear Putin talk about the prospect of them all coming together in some form. I don't know whether he's really seriously thinking about it or not, but you know, there are a lot of potential formulations out there. Does anybody else want to ask a question or make a comment? We've all been sitting here very patiently and obviously thinking various things. Please. Yes, please come to the mic.
Actually, I wanted to ask a quick question about return of the IDPs to Abkhazian territories, especially ones that didn't have anything to do with the conflict and they were forced out of their homes. And what is the, like, why Abkhazians feel that it's threatening, actually, for getting the Georgians back, or Mingrelians mostly, mm-hmm. that was the population in Abkhazian region, back?
It's an interesting question. And what was striking to us on our last trip to Abkhazia was that it was the one question for which the Abkhaz had no answer. I mean, I'm being very honest, but they just had no answer. So we would say, you know, there's all these IDPs in Tbilisi, in Zugdidi, wherever. They want to come home. What do you do about that? Right? We're talking to Abkhaz officials.
Yeah, official policy?
And they would say, well, if they want to, they can. Well, that's not really true, you know. They're all back already. They didn't have an answer to that. And that's a finding, right? I mean, this is, and the reason for that, I think, is that it goes against the narrative of the creation of the Abkhaz state, right?
Because if all the ideas, and this is why these solutions don't work, right? Because for much of the years, much of the time preceding the war, solutions to the problem were, okay, first the IDPs return. Okay, well, if you begin with that, right, let's move it to another region. If you're negotiating around the Palestine-Israel issue and you say, okay, first all the Palestinians get the right to return. Okay, now the Israelis and the Americans have walked out of the room, right, and the discussion's over. And for the Abkhaz, it's a deal breaker, that the discussion's over, for the reasons that it's not Abkhazia if you bring those IDPs back. I'm not saying I sympathize with the Abkhaz government at all. I'm just saying that's their position. And until that changes, this is an enormous stumbling block. This is, in our view, one of the reasons why we take such a strong position against recognition, right? And we actually say, you know, the U.S. should strengthen that position, right? Take a position that strengthens it, because that would give us the room to engage a little bit.
Yeah. There's actually an interesting experiment in nationhood going on with the Abkhaz now, and they're extremely demographically challenged, right? Given the absence of 200,000 to 250,000 IDPs in Georgia, they still, ethnic Abkhaz don't constitute a majority within Abkhazia, right? And some people doubt whether they're even an ethnic plurality when compared to the ethnic Armenians. So the Abkhaz course to quote-unquote state building, or what they consider to be state building, is to try and set aside the IDP issue. And as Lincoln said, they don't have even an official line on this, which is actually shocking. And on the other side, to try and paint themselves as this kind of tolerant, pluralistic, civic type of group that takes all sorts of minorities. Ukrainians, Russians, Armenians, Abkhaz will all live together in sort of pluralistic democracy in Abkhazia. Except for the fact that the official institutions of the Abkhaz state now want to promote the Abkhaz language. And this is really the most difficult issue now internally that they're seeing a lot of pushback on. That the Abkhaz diaspora, on which they really hung a lot of their hopes, like all these hundreds of thousands of Abkhaz, you know, would sort of pick up from Turkey in return, they come back to Turkey and they fight completely Russified. Mm-hmm. It's a very alien sort of place for them. So in turn, then they pass an Abkhaz language law, which then alienates the Russian speakers. So this process of Abkhaz national identity construction is very difficult, and one that's having a lot of unintended consequences for the Abkhaz at the moment. But you're absolutely right about the IDP issue. It's a huge issue, and frankly, I'm surprised they don't have a better public line on the IDP issue.
What's the line on the Gali region? Because you mentioned before in response to the question about the risks or the fears of the Abkhaz about being partitioned at some point between Russia and Georgia. And, of course, there's been a lot of ideas floated around indeed of just that.
That's right.
Of basically finding a resolution in which Abkhazia agrees to give up Gali for some kind of recognition, even by Georgia, of its independence. And, of course, Gali wasn't traditionally an area where the Abkhaz were in a majority. It was a majority ethnic Georgian region. So, I mean, is that even also set to one side, the Gali region, precisely because of these kinds of fears?
Yes and no. I mean, Gali... they'll say Gali has representation in the Abkhaz parliament, that it has, you know, the full entitlements to sort of the Abkhaz state and representations and so forth. But anyone who's been to Gali, right, and we transited through Gali both times, just the level of disrepair in Gali is absolutely shocking. I mean, and again, one of the differences in June 2000. In 2008 and in April 2010 when we visited Abkhazia was, you know, Gali was even worse in 2010 because the entire roads had just been, you know, chewed up by armored vehicles rolling in and just hadn't been replaced. And I think one of the Russian strategies that you see is to fix up the roads and the highways going north and all that infrastructure and to not give a dime for what's going on in the south and sort of make it really clear where your future lies. And then that infrastructure, I also think, has consequences. Now, whether Gali itself could be traded in the future, I actually think the Abkhaz would jump at a chance to be recognized and sort of give away Gali, which really is a problem for them in a lot of different ways. I don't know if that's, you know, if I'd sign on entirely onto sort of Dmitry Tenin's plan, for instance, and sort of create the dual Andorra-like structure for South Ossetia. But yes, it's a problem for Abkhazia, but the region itself is just so desolate and depressing that it's a pocket of concern, I think, for everyone.
Did you pick up on the Armenian issue very much? And by this I mean that you mentioned that the Abkhaz, there's a push, at least at the top level of the government, for the Abkhaz language. But it also seems that from other reports in the region that the Armenian population in Abkhazia, which of course in many respects is indigenous, this is not just settlers from elsewhere. I mean, these are Armenians who have lived there for an extraordinarily long time, have become really dominant in the business sector. So there's sort of a duality now in Abkhazia where the business sector, private sector, is dominated by Armenians and the Abkhaz are dominating the political side. Are there signs of tension there? How are they going to mesh this in their sort of new civic identity? And what does that mean for the U.S., that's a very complicated issue, given our own complications with our Armenian diaspora and Nagorno-Karabakh and all the other issues.
And it's interesting, and it becomes an issue for the global Armenian diaspora, right? If there are real problems there, if the Armenians are really under threat there, it becomes a different kind of issue. And we were struck that the Georgian government has said that essentially there's apartheid situation for the Armenians, which is, I mean, we were told that at Columbia. I'm not sure that we got that sense there. Now, we didn't spend a lot of time on this issue. The language issue, is clearly one that could change that, right? If Armenians aren't going to learn Abkhaz, right? The lingua franca in Abkhazia is Russian, and the Russians certainly aren't going to learn Abkhaz. But we didn't spend a lot of time on this. There's no Armenians in the political leadership that we encountered. I mean, there's no Armenian surnames. We were... as we walked out of one of the buildings, we, saw somebody who we met the last time. We told him he's the head of the Armenian, civic association, which could mean anything, right? But that there's a head of a community that represents, 30-odd% of the people is also a little bit, indicates a few things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other aspect of this, I think, Fiona, on your question sort of how the Armenians fit in, is we're also hearing a lot of signs of renewed tension over Russian investments and Russian investors complaining about running into local obstacles, right, and sort of mafia-like gangs sort of controlled by sort of ethnic Armenians, right, defending their turf. And so I think there's also a potential Russian-Armenian dynamic for control of businesses in Abkhazia. What the U.S. can do about this, honestly, I don't have a clue. Very little, again, if you don't have any sort of instruments of being, I mean, it's just on a very basic level. As we were going out to Abkhazia and trying to sort of coordinate with our fixer and so forth, we realized we couldn't even make a cellular phone call to Abkhazia, right? Because the lines are disconnected. So we ended up, phoning our assistant in Tbilisi to get in touch with a counterpart in Abkhazia on landline through Skype.
Through
the internet to avoid these sorts of blockages. So just to give you an idea of just the isolation and segmentation that makes it just very difficult for any kinds of sort of human-to-human kind of contacts.
I'd heard that actually one of the Turkish cell phone companies was trying to set up given the proximity. But that you mentioned about the Turkish Abkhaz diaspora. Of course, in Turkey, Abkhaz language was also not taught. So a lot of the Abkhaz living in Turkey are only Turkic speakers, which isn't desperately helpful for returning.
Our diaspora is going to come back and rebuild our country is what you say to foreign visitors when you have nothing else to say, right?
Right.
I mean, it's kind of a platitude, and it has worked in a very small handful of countries. It has not worked, in many countries. So this, I remember in 2008 kind of smiling when I was told that and thinking that's not ever going to happen. And these regions, It is. If you're not a product of the Soviet Union, post-Soviet Russia, Abkhazia is a very tough place to function, a very tough place to do business. And the fact that you might be able to speak Abkhaz there, and you speak Turkish, is not going to really be an incentive.
But this is a prime project of sort of Mr. Shamba, right? The whole diaspora sort of returning. He's really sort of trying to work this, and it gets back to just numbers and demography. Abkhazia is empty. Right. One of the most striking things, again, when you travel around Abkhazia is just how empty the place is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we talk about this a little bit. We have a kind of a travelogue piece over the summer in the World Policy Journal. When you just see, especially when you go southwards, just miles and miles of just desolate buildings, squares.
But even in Suchumi. You go to, you know, the handful of restaurants, and there's just, you know, and it's one of these, it's almost like, you know how in a play sometimes there's one guy playing six characters? Now I'm the bellhop. Now I'm the cook. Now I'm the best friend. Now I'm the driver. It has that feel to it because there's just nobody there, and everyone has to wear seven hats.
One other issue to touch upon in terms of sort of timelines and points that Fiona was making is what's going to happen to all this in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics? This is really interesting. So 2014, and mentioned sort of the Circassian issue, and of course, by some unfortunate coincidence, this is going to be right on the anniversary of sort of the Circassian defeat by the Russian Imperial Army. You could see it going both ways. On the one hand, you could see sort of Georgia jumping at the chance to use Sochi as a landmark event to sort of question Russia's Abkhazia policy, right? And to point out what they're doing, that these are illegal constructions, illegal workers' camps, right? Tens of thousands of laborers for Sochi are going to be housed in Abkhazia, right? Which actually is going to alter the demography of Abkhazia, right? On the other hand, the optimistic view would be maybe this will be an impetus for Moscow to show a bit of flexibility and start dealing with Tbilisi on some of these issues, right? Because they don't want these games that are so important, especially now to Prime Minister Putin, a real kind of symbol of his new, you know, international prowess when he managed to get these from the IOC, embarrassing him, right? By having sort of quasi-Bogue boycotts and demonstrations and appeals to sort of the legality of workers' camps and stuff like that. So that's a deadline too, 2014, and I'm not sure which way it's going to go yet.
So a lot of key dates here. We talked about the elections and then also the Sochi Olympics. Does anybody have a final question or comment? Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Greg Beyer, and I work in the investment business. What's happening with the pipeline? And how important do you think it was to the conflict starting, and how important is it right now for everybody?
Baku Tbilisi.
A pipeline can be an engine of regional integration, and regional economic growth, or it can be a metal tube through which gas flows. In Georgia, it's been more of the latter, frankly. The BTC has been more of the latter, I should say. You know, we in America, we understand that wars are about oil, right? I mean, that's the prism through which we see everything, right? I mean, wars, you know, we understand that. Iraq again, we understand that. I don't know that that's the case here. The kind of a Caucasus narrative that this Azeri oil is, you know, essential to the functioning of the Western world is not really in line with where resources really are. So my sense is that it's a secondary issue. What this was more about is kind of global power politics. Georgia-Russia issues, some of the issues Fiona laid out, I think the energy issues are secondary.
Yeah, what was actually kind of fascinating about this is that, you know, the Russians took some care not to bomb the BTC pipeline, right, to not have it be accused of doing that because it didn't want to bring that dimension to it. And Georgia said, well, the pipeline was shut down. Actually, the pipeline was shut down because of events in Turkey, right, that started happening a few days before the war. And so it sort of fortuitously, I guess, remained shut down during the course of the war. But this also gets to some interesting questions about sort of Georgia's role as a kind of a Caspian hub. And, you know, a lot of proponents of Georgia's strategic situation say, you see, it's the crossroads of the east-west energy corridor. It's the vital place for sort of energy coming to the Western market. Companies don't view Georgia in the same way. They see Georgia and they see the region. They say, this is transit risk. We can't be investing billions of dollars into places where you have these wars started, where these pipelines are vulnerable. This is how you get something as goofy as Nord Stream, right? I mean, there's an economic calculation. It's not just about sort of the Germans love the Russians and the Russians love the Germans kind of narrative. It's saying, no, we want to bypass all of these places, you know, Ukraine, Georgia, anywhere we have this sort of political risk, we don't want to deal with it. And so I think there's a dual side to sort of Georgia's energy hub. Like, we view it as strategically vital, but in the private sector, it's not exactly sort of viewed that way. I don't know if you would agree with that.
But the Russians did try to play that up after the fact. I mean, there were comments by Foreign Minister Lavrov, for example, saying, see, we told you it was risky putting a pipeline through Georgia.
Yeah, that's right.
Although they didn't really play that up in the in the run-up to the war and during the war, but it was certainly after the fact. It was became part of the sort of later narrative of the warnings about just generally doing dealings with Georgia.
Georgia?
It's fairly minuscule. I mean, in the run-up to the war, there was the coincidence of having a National Guard training exercise with the Georgians, but I can't recall how many U.S. troops were there. It was
I've
very small
hundreds,
numbers,
yeah.
But you know, as you recall, they kept a low profile, but the Russians actually took great delight in looting all of their equipment, and you'll remember the pictures of them driving around in National Guard Humvees, which I don't think we got back. I think they were taken off to be sort of the spoils of war somewhere. But in terms of military personnel trainers, beyond the sort of regular defense attachés and others who were there, it's a very small number, and was always pretty much focused on the coalition in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. So that wasn't really an issue at all. Of course, the Russians like to exaggerate that, and there's been a great deal of accusations of the country crawling. You may actually recall there was a very bizarre incident where they claimed to have found the passport of some special operative, and it actually turned out to be some U.S. volunteer from the Peace Corps whose passport had been stolen in somewhere like Pakistan, and his passport suddenly appeared miraculously and weirdly during the conflict. But that became a source of embarrassment for the Russian government and military after the kind of fact this guy was located, I think, somewhere on a beach in Thailand or something, and noted that, yes, his passport had been stolen some time ago and he had no idea what had happened to it. I don't think that's quite right, but it was a sort of the general kind of image of sort of the absurdity of the situation. So there's a lot of hype about things that the US is supposed to be doing when, in fact, we're not really doing any of the things that we're accused of. Does anybody else have any final thoughts before you want to dash for the wine and what's left of the snacks? And also, of course, taking the reports home for your friends, great, relatives and neighbours. No? Well, I'd like to then thank very much Lincoln and Alex, not just for the stellar work on the report, which, although you will have noticed from especially the allusions to various discussions, has not been universally welcomed, perhaps, by the Georgian government. I think it's actually stimulated a lot of debate about just exactly what they set out to do, which is what is the right premise and way forward for the relationship between the US and Georgia. And even if we won't be seeing the report on the front page of the New York Times, and let's hope, again, as you're saying, a mark of success, in fact, we find the right relationship will be that Georgia is not always on the front page of the New York Times, but is there for positive stories rather than where we saw it in August 2008. I think that will also be, in many respects, thanks to you doing this report and really getting everybody thinking about this in a very serious way. So I'd like to thank you very much for coming here and thanking OSI and Anthony Richter and all of his colleagues for putting this on, and encourage everyone to take copies. And what's your next event, Anthony, that we can let everybody know about? I'll hand over to you, and just a general thanks on my behalf too for inviting me here.
The next event, I think, is going to be in the middle of October in Washington. I think one of our, Alex, are you also in the lineup on that one? We'll be publishing a report by Laura Lumpy, which is a study analyzing the comparative spending of the U.S. Pentagon versus the State Department, looking at the Central Asia and the where the center of balance of spending is going, I guess you can guess.
If you include Afghanistan in Central Asia, then it'll be obvious.
No. Afghanistan doesn't enter into the calculation. Thank you all
thank you
very much, Fiona, Lincoln, and Alex.
Thank you.